Down.
Hello.
Welcome to Think Visual with Shapeshifters. The tables have turned today. You are the interviewee.
This is all strangely familiar. Yes. I should be wearing that t-shirt. Damn it. What is this?
I specifically asked you not to, so that there's a bit of differentiation today, because usually you're the host. For the past few ones, you've been the host. So. Mm-hmm. Yes, but I think it also puts you in the mindset of you're not the one asking questions today.
We'll see about that.
Okay, are we going to include all of that?
Quite possibly. Why not?
Maybe, yeah.
Okay.
Give people a glimpse into
what's actually going on behind the scenes.
Yeah.
We seem all friendly and nice and happy, and actually we're crazy. Crazy.
It's a bit of a play.
Yes.
Okay, well, can you please start by telling us a little bit about your origin story? I think everyone knows you because you're the face of Think Visual.
Am I?
We do the meetups. We're the face of Think Visual, but we do the meetups. We bring other speakers. We've been doing this podcast series. But I think people are always curious about you, and they can see the incredible talent and superpower that you have. And I think it would be great to give them a little bit of a glimpse of where that comes from.
Okay. A little bit of context. Okay.
Yeah.
Where do I begin? I think, for me, I would say it genuinely begins at, in my childhood. Because I've kind of always known that I'm a visual person, always. So I recognized early on that I guess I kind of think differently. I recall probably some of my earliest memories of my teachers thinking that something was wrong with me. So I was schooled in the 80s. And even in kindergarten, I remember my teachers. Well, my teacher in particular, she constantly told me to stop drawing. And I guess, in kindy, I don't exactly possess the words to explain that I'm not just drawing anything, and that some part of what I was doing is probably connected to what was going on. So I kind of always knew that I am a visual person, and as I started to grow up, I think it became a bit more of a conscious act slowly through school. And it was kind of hard going at the time because, again, it was being schooled in the 80s. Seeing somebody approach work in a illustrative manner was a little bit weird for my teachers. And some took it better than others. Some people encouraged me and said, This is great. I can see that this is, like, I think in year one, my teacher, she was instrumental to me following the path of using visual thinking. And I think she could see then clearly that there was some kind of connection in my drawings. It wasn't just random doodles. And even though there was a lot of random doodles, there was a lot, but not all of it was random. So, I mean, I draw, superheroes, werewolves, monsters of all kinds, dinosaurs. But there was also parts of the page that were dedicated to what was being said and what was happening.
So, yeah, I was going to ask about that, because when you say I'm a visual person, especially as a kid, like, I think we all say we're visual, or a lot of people say they're visual people.
Yeah.
And also, almost all kids draw and doodle all the time. So what made you actually different? Like, was there anything that you felt was different?
Definitely. I think the way I describe it is that when people would speak, I would immediately get very detailed, crisp images in my mind of what it is they were talking about. So I think an example would be if someone said the word dog, I wouldn't just get a picture of any random dog. I would get all the pictures of all the dogs that I'd ever seen, and they all start to kind of cram my head full of things. And I think that was very hard to initially process, and it made things like spelling slow for me. So it's not that I was dyslexic. And some of the teachers were like, oh, Alan's learning progress is rather slow in this. But then other teachers were saying there's a bit of a contrast, because they can see that I have some initial problems with dictation, you know, that exercise where the teachers are kind of speaking out the words and I'm trying to spell it out. I struggled immensely with that. But then again, I was reading Narnia when I was 7 or 8 years old, and no problem reading through any of those books. I loved reading those books because my mind would create this rich imagery, three-dimensional worlds that I could actually see and experience. So I guess that was what was a little bit different. I could see everything that was being said to me with no delay. Like, it would instantly occur, and it would be kind of confusing because I didn't know exactly what I was supposed to do with it. And I thought that everyone thought the same way. I believe that everyone thinks the same way up until recently. I remember we were chatting and I was like, you see it like that, right? And you were saying, no, you don't see things that way. So,
no.
It's kind of like rich imagery that's in my mind, and it took purposeful consideration and training and encouragement for me to know that, okay, I don't need everything. I just need one image or two.
Wow.
So, yeah.
That must have taken a lot of practice and training.
Yeah, it took me all of primary school, all of high school to get it right. And even in all of throughout high school, I didn't get it right. It was still kind of sporadic bursts. There was a bit more structure, you know. But then when I went to fine arts school, studied fine arts at Sydney College of the Arts for a year, largely what we were doing was creating visual things, and it was helpful, but I think my mind was seeking more structure. And then when I heard about Enmore School of Design, I went there, the things that they were teaching me about composition, about layout, how to use typography, how to use color, and it just instantly made sense to me. I said, oh, this is what I've been missing. It's like somebody gave me a toolkit and said, these are some of the tools that you need. And all of the crazy stuff that goes on in your mind can be made a little easier to manage, or can be tempered if you use these tools. And then from there, it became so much smoother for me. I was like, oh, there's this thing called page layouts. And I can now figure out where to place things on a page. And then when I eventually went to the film school to study, it seemed like everything flowed even more smoothly, because there they were specifically looking at visual storytelling. So, you know, as a filmmaker, you are trained to look for and craft imagery that usually conveys highly complex story concepts, emotions. You know, if you take any great film and you analyze them frame by frame, you can see so much information packed into one moment, into 1 second. There's just so many things happening. And film school really helped me then kind of put it all together in a way that was very, I guess, palatable in a way, and accessible.
Mm.
Like, more people could understand what I was talking about.
That's amazing. Actually, you're talking about a type of neurodivergence, right? We've been talking a little bit more recently about aphantasia and hyperphantasia, and all that you've described in your experience, it's a type of neurodivergence. Is that correct? And
yeah, that is.
Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah. So, I've known about aphantasia for a good many years, actually. Now it's probably since the days of design college, where you and I were starting to work together. I, I first came across it then. This would have been around the 2014, 2015 period. So I think I came across it then, and I'd never given that any thought before. Like I just assumed that everybody could see things the way I was seeing things. And then when I heard that there was this condition where people did not have the ability to see with their mind's eye, I was really surprised. I went, wow, there's different ways. And I guess it should have been obvious to me all this time, because of course we don't all think alike. Thinking is a deeply personal, activity, right?
And especially with your experience in school.
Oh, yeah.
You were thinking basically different than all the other kids.
I think I just thought that something was wrong as a kid, or, that maybe I was struggling. I don't know. I just learned in a way that was inefficient, perhaps. Mm. And when I found out about aphantasia, it was kind of interesting. But aphantasia kind of opened my eyes, because I was like, wow, there's this way of thinking that is so opposite of what I'm seeing. And actually only in recent years did I find out about hyperphantasia, like in the last 2 years. And I thought, what's this? And when I read about hyperphantasia, something suddenly clicked. I suddenly realized that, oh, I think this is the thing that I've been experiencing my whole life, which is, where you get very rich imagery in your head, so rich sometimes that it looks like it's right there. So it was kind of weird. And I as I said, I only recently found out about it, but hyperphantasia and aphantasia are two ends of a spectrum of thinking. Let's call it visual thinking, right? So one end, you get the most extreme vivid visualizations. The other end, you get nothing at all. And so I'm on this, I don't know, I'm sure within hyperphantasia there's other extremes, but I'm on the hyperphantasia side of things, as in I get rich imagery. It's also context and subject specific. So some things give me more, some things give me less. It depends on familiarity. It's an interesting neurodiverse way of thinking. It's not a disability. It's just a neurodiverse way of thinking. It's literally different ways of mental processing.
Yeah, and when you were talking about you thought at school that something was wrong with you, it's actually more that the system, something was wrong with the system, because it's just designed for one type of learner. And so, that's unfortunate, but it sounds like you found different ways to thrive and you had the right support.
Yeah, I definitely did. I've had good voices. My parents were both teachers, and they I guess they knew that I wasn't dumb. They used to always say to me, hey, look, if you learn differently, you've got to find the way you learn. And then learn that way and then work that way. You can't just stay neutral and accept things the way they are. Be active. Mm. And I guess that those words, my mum and dad's words, always stayed in my head. Be active. Seek for what it is that you are, that appeals to you, that helps you.
And that makes a lot of sense. I mean, we're always talking about superpowers. Mm. And you got to find what's your strength and then just leverage that. So... Yeah. You studied filmmaking, and then how did you get here?
I guess through strange and unexpected means. I think the filmmaking side of things is a bit more direct in a way. Like, okay, so if you follow my trajectory, drawing all through school, then in uni doing fine arts for a year, pretty predictable, right? Then going to do graphic design and studying visual design, super helpful because it was like mastery of elements. Mm. Then from studying graphic design to doing filmmaking, which was like a the one visual craft that includes all other visual crafts, right? Because you're using spatial, you're using light, you're using so many different elements, as well as 2D things.
Yeah.
But from film school, I spent most of my creative career in filmmaking, probably 12 years of my creative career. As an independent filmmaker, I worked on commercials, I worked on feature films, music videos, lots and lots of different things, just ads and fun creative stuff and all kinds of things. But one thing that was interesting is that all throughout my creative career, I was also teaching. I came across this... ad years and years ago, which was to teach at a small design college, and it was to teach the things that I know really well, which is filmmaking and illustration and visual design. I was like, I know this quite well. I can definitely do this. And they were after somebody who had industry experience. Back then it was Raffles KVB. And I went to teach there, and I had a great relationship with the people who were coordinating the courses and the program directors, and I guess they liked some of the stuff that I was doing there. And all through that time, there was this a nice tension between what I know to do intrinsically, and then how to explain it to others. Mm. In a way that is repeatable. And I got lots of practice doing that. Mm-hmm. And it was towards the apex of that time that I got the opportunity to lead a design college. And that's when I got to work with you. And, you know, that was a lot of fun. We had two good years together and taught lots of, you know, great students and build and design courses that we were very proud of. And then when that kind of chapter came to a close, I had this almost like a complete blank canvas of going anywhere. And it was, as I said, the closing period of that time, I was introduced into design consulting through you. I met people at Tobias, and then the time at Tobias that I spent, I was focusing on strategic design consulting through the lens of a visual communication practitioner, and I got to utilize my filmmaking skills, I got to utilize my live drawing skills, which I had honed, weirdly enough, through teaching others. I mean, I guess it's kind of predictable in a way, because when we're teaching illustration, I have to annotate and illustrate what it is that I'm talking about. So I would always find myself drawing concepts, and the live drawing part was part and parcel with the teaching. And teaching I spent a long time doing. So at Tobias, I did the teaching bit, I did the filmmaking bit. I got to exercise my design mind on many different projects to think about things in different ways. And it was at the end of that time that I realized that this was something that I could offer. This, it was like the sum total of all the things that I'd ever worked on had now given me a unique opportunity to be able to help organizations and people in a way that is unlike anything else. And that's I guess how we started Shapeshifters. I mean, technically we started Shapeshifters while we were actually teaching together, but you know, to help people in this way that we're doing now, I think it came towards the end of my time consulting, came towards the end of your time as a visual communication lead, you know, at the college that you were teaching at. And it was like the sum total of, okay, apply all this educational knowledge that we have all this consulting and all this crazy creative industry stuff, and we can help people in ways that are truly unique and innovative. Yeah, that's how I got here.
I have to say, Alan, every time I've heard this, I've heard your journey and your story so many times, and every time I listen to it, it's just very inspiring, and I'm in awe because it's just so rich, and you can really tell that all of that, like every single part of your journey, led to this. Like it kind of formed you bit by bit.
Yeah.
Formed your thinking, formed your approach, and now what we do today at Shapeshifters, it feels like it's really the culmination of all of it. And I feel like a lot of our work stands out because of the combination of that history that you have. I think also if I am to describe you in one word, it would be storyteller. It wouldn't be illustrator. It would be more storyteller. And it's because no matter what medium, even when you're telling a story, you know, just by words, it's very rich in imagery, in emotion, and narrative. Like you're just a very good storyteller. And when you combine that with your visual skills, it's very powerful. And I guess what I want to know is, based on all of that, like all of your, that crazy visual journey that you went through to really understand who you are as a visual thinker, how do you use it today? And how does what we do at Shapeshifters really reflect that?
That's a great question. How I use visual thinking today is evolved, has definitely evolved a lot over time. I think I've become comfortable with knowing that my way of thinking can be of great benefit. So I think if you see me drawing, I'm thinking, and I'm kind of drawing all the time. So in conversations, at conferences, for myself, for other people, it's reflexive. So I guess the way I use it now is more purposeful. A lot of times I do things because I need it myself. I don't often draw, I think, because I want to show others. Like my sketchbooks and my iPad, and it's just littered with sketches because it's just how I think. I need to get the ideas from my mind out so that I can see and understand what it is that's kind of going on. I can process my thoughts. It's like a part of my thinking must happen externally.
You also mentioned that it's not as appealing and amazing as it sounds.
Yeah, I mean, hyperphantasia, I think with any extremes, there are benefits and then there are challenges. Mm. I think the benefits are, there's basically nothing that I hear that doesn't produce visuals in my mind. There's always visuals. And the richness or the lack of richness is dependent on the context and, you know, emotional state and lots of other things too. But I always have visuals. The challenges are trying to manage what goes on in my mind. And also, you know, there are certain things that are harder for me to let go of in some way. So extremely emotional moments, traumas, they're very vivid in my mind. I can hear the sounds and I can see so richly. It's kind of, in some ways, it's kind of hard to shake off. Mm. and it requires active work. So I can't just kind of let it be. I actually have to think about it intentionally and find ways to process the the thoughts in my mind. It's, you know, it's also like, I think I mentioned this to you before, as a filmmaker, whenever I was thinking about stories and narratives, if I didn't start writing them out and if I didn't film them, they would gnaw at my mind constantly, as in there's this constant pressure on my brain. It was like they, if they didn't come out on paper on, or on film, they would eat me up alive in some way. So sometimes it's it can be overwhelming, but I guess that's what it kind of comes with, the territory of being able to see things with extreme vividness. The benefits are I can kind of prototype anything on the spot, like really, really quickly. But the downsides are sometimes it's too much. So I guess over the years, I've just learned to kind of balance that. But it does make our work at Shapeshifters really different, because you process things visually too, slightly different than me. And I think that the different ways that we do that makes our work really special, because when people work with us, there's a lot of transparency. It's open. You can see what's going on. There's no, I'm not hiding behind screens. You are literally seeing my thoughts and your conversation meld together in front of your eyes with nothing to hide. Like it's a lot of, I think it builds trust. It builds connection with people. It also saves time.
Like, you're referring to the co-design approach that we use where we're basically live sketching, or you're usually live sketching, I'm talking, with clients so that we can get to the results quicker.
I think so. I mean, one thing that I'd love people to know is that it can work both ways. I can do the question asking and you can do the sketching. I think the reason we kind of typically go with that is it's the lowest point of resistance. It's quite easy. You're very inquisitive and you love to ask questions. Yeah. And I'm very illustrative because I think that way. So it's very natural that we just go, okay, default is that.
Yeah.
But we can comfortably swap. So yes, I'm thinking about the co-design, but I'm also thinking about whenever we communicate and work with people, even if it's not during a co-design session, the visuals that we're creating, they're an extension of the conversations and the trust that we've built. Rarely do I feel like there's any surprises in, you know, it's not that people aren't surprised with the things. It's more like they did not see something that they didn't help or have a hand in creating.
Yeah, we're literally bringing them along on the journey, because they can see the very, very roughest sketch, but it's actually their ideas coming on paper. So it's very personal for them. So they're right there from the beginning.
And I think the finesse, the finish that we create, it's a nice thing that we bring because of the experience that we have, but it's actually it's not as valuable as the part where we are actually able to bring people along together and do things together, because it makes it so much more clear. I think clarity is the really important part. People are clear about what it is that they're getting and what it is that they're designing, because it's literally appearing right before their eyes.
And you and I have talked about this a lot. We, because of our background in, you know, consulting and education and design, like all of these different things, and visual communication and storytelling, we've talked about what is it that we actually do, because it's not just visual thinking where we just create images in real time. There's a little bit more, and I'm talking about obviously the services that we offer at Shapeshifters. Maybe really quickly, why do we call ourselves communication design? What we do is communication design, and specifically, I suppose we've been angling a little bit towards strategic communication, and why do we call it that?
So another good question. If you can picture the iceberg diagram, right, where there's the tip of the iceberg, and everyone sees, you know, the fact that we illustrate, the fact that we're visual thinkers, that's right at the very, very top. It's, you know, it's the things that are easily identifiable as us. Mm. I think the thing that goes underneath, the massiveness of what happens underneath is our rich understanding of design and the design process, our understanding that strategy is something that happens over a period of time. It's not something that, you know, is accidental or you hope works away. It's very intentional, and we know how to work intentionally towards things. So we understand strategy, we understand design, and the communication part of it, we understand that intimately well because that's our background. You know, we are great at all forms of communication. So I think we can speak, sure. We can create illustrations, definitely. But we also can craft beautiful videos. We can wireframe and prototype. There's almost no way of, no form of communication that we are not well versed in. We also write copy for many of our clients as well, because part of my background is writing as well. I've written screenplays, worked as a script editor. It's part and parcel with the all of the creative industries that we've worked in, and we bring all of that richness. It's, I think, between you and me together, there's over 30 years, like 35, almost 40 years worth of creative experience that we bring to a table, and that's quite a lot. That's quite unique. Yeah. Not easily replicable.
Yeah. I was thinking, is this starting to sound a bit too much like marketing? We're promoting what we do, but really, because I actually think that this is really worth talking about, because not a lot of people really see the value of it. And yeah, people sometimes look at what we do or come up to you at an event and they're like, wow, how did you do that? You know? And it's true. It's kind of, it's a little bit like magic what you create at an event, right there on the spot. But the other part of it is when we're talking to a business or a team, and then we hear the struggles they're having, usually a lot of times it's because there's miscommunication. And a lot of times we immediately can see that miscommunication can be resolved pretty easily through visual communication, because it's the way that we communicate intuitively with each other, but also it kind of removes barriers, right? It simplifies complexity. And now I'm starting to sound a bit jargon,
I think, but it's no accident that it's visuals that we use, because here's the thing. My words can easily be misconstrued. You can understand it one way. Someone else can understand it a completely different way. And that's because our relationship with words is different than our relationship with imagery. With words, people can switch off, ignore, they can skip parts. They can often say, oh, I didn't hear that part. I didn't hear it like that. With images, we don't have any filters on our, you know, our eyes are actually the filters for our minds, and they don't filter anything. They actually, so when we walk around, like we walk around with our eyes open and do our thing, we're taking in like billions and billions of bits of information instantaneously without us even knowing. And so if you use visuals to communicate, you're already using something that can immediately cut through and get into the mind rapidly. But the other thing is we're using it in a way because we understand that the craft of visual communication allows us to make messages stand out and stick to the mind, so they can be retained in your memory for much longer than, you know, if you said something, it's so easy to forget.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we're coming to the almost the end of our conversation, but I wanted to ask you. You mentioned before. Let's call phantasia and hyperphantasia and aphantasia the visual thinking kind of spectrum. Do you think that's actually the case, or is there a little bit of a differentiation? Because in my head, the mind's eye, and we know some people who have aphantasia and are amazing sketchnoters and visual thinkers. What's the difference, and can someone grow in visual thinking even if they're not, you know, as they don't think as vividly as you do?
Oh yeah, even as vivid as my mind is, if I sketch things down, I have a much better understanding than when I just leave it in my head. Mm. Even me, and I can see things quite vividly. So whether you have aphantasia or phantasia or hyperphantasia, you can hone this your ability to think visually if you apply it in the physical sense. There's something very special that happens when you pick up a pen and you write things and sketch things out on a piece of paper. The paper itself kind of speaks back to you. So there's this unique relationship that happens. And also the other thing is the physical act of sketching activates different parts of the brain that do not become active if you're typing things out. Those parts of the brains, that part of the brain is not active. It's called the parietal lobe. So when you're sketching, the parietal lobe is activated, and it's the language center of your mind. It's the cognition part of your mind. So you are enhancing your memory, allowing your brain to process things from more angles, and then creating a deeper connection to the knowledge that you are absorbing and listening to. So anyone can get better. It doesn't matter which part of the spectrum they sit on, they can actually improve their visual thinking ability. It doesn't matter if you have hyperphantasia or aphantasia, you can definitely improve. And I'm proof of that. I've got better and better slowly over time. And, you know, it's, I would recommend it to everybody. Yeah.
So what, do you have any tips that you can give to someone who's never sketched before, doesn't hold a pen, maybe only types on the computer?
Start small, start short. Like, don't spend too long on things. Even if you just doodle while you're on the phone for 30 seconds to 1 minute, it's better than if you just put it off, and you're waiting for this. Oh, I'm going to wait for this creative time where I'm going to start sketching and I'm going to work on my abilities. Don't do that. Just little bit by little bit. Just do a little bit every day. And if you can squeeze in a tiny bit every single day, it has this compounding effect. Like, you will build muscle memory. It's like, honestly, visual thinking is more so like driving and riding a bike than a really fine skill. Mm. It's more like a general skill that improves and is enhanced with little practice each day.
Yeah, well, I mean, we talk about it as a visual language, right?
Yeah.
And the more you've got a grasp of that language, the more you can write and communicate with it.
That's right. Yeah. So you got to use it or lose it.
Okay, one last tip to someone who is a visual thinker. They love to sketch and think on paper, but doesn't know where to take it from there. And also is maybe busy with work and things like that. How would they, can they bring that in to their work or life?
Yeah, don't wait for permission. If you're somebody who already has a bit of skill, just do it and apply it wherever you are, however you can. So lowest common denominator. There's no tool that is truly required other than a piece of paper and a pencil. Nothing fancier. Like the tools that you need, you can either obtain for free or cost less than a dollar. So they're super cheap, super accessible, and apply it anywhere, like in any context you can. I guess the other tips I would say is, we have a pretty cool little course. You should go and do that. It's called Think Visual. So that one's pretty comprehensive. It's like a great little way for people to start off their journey. But it's also good for people who already have some skills and just want to hone. I would say the bottom line is just start, just apply it. Apply it as soon as you can, wherever you are.
I was also thinking, come to our meetup because,
everyone
there is sketching. No one is, it's quite a safe place and we just have fun.
And, imagine being in a room with 50 other people or so, who are all sketching and trying it out. You'll feel encouraged because no one there is, judging how you look or how it is that, how the visual is that you've created. In fact, the opposite is true. People are just, really kind of bring you on board. And if you want encouragement, if you want feedback, if you want ideas, if you want techniques, you just have to look over your shoulder and you'll see someone doing something interesting in a way that you probably didn't expect. I've been doing this with you, Diana, for now a year, and there's still ways that I see that surprise me. So it's pretty cool. People should come along for sure.
Yeah, for sure. Well, thanks, Alan. Where can people find you if they want to follow what you do and get more or know more about what you do?
I think LinkedIn's probably the best place. I post quite a bit on LinkedIn.
Yep.
I don't post as much on my Instagram except for during Inktober. So my Instagram is Fable Us. We'll include that in the show notes.
We'll include that in the show notes.
Obviously, the Shapeshifters website, but the LinkedIn is probably the best place. And yeah, I regularly post thoughts, articles, video links, drawings, that kind of thing.
And if they want to meet you in person, they can come to the Think Visual.
Come to Think Visual or Sydney Design Thinking.
Sydney Design Thinking as well. Yeah. Great. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for your time today, Alan.
Of course. You're welcome.